I'm reminded of the old joke about the Lawrence Welk show about, Helen, quickly, turn off the bubble machine. Remember the old Lawrence Welk show? They'd open up with their champagne.
We had one TV, and on Sunday night, they had Secret Agent Man. They had all these nice, you know, spy
right.
things I used to love to watch. And my dad and mom would have Lawrence Welk on. Let's Bobby and Sissy do the polka. Oh, what a torture.
I was on the Lawrence Welk show once, actually. But that was a long time ago, and we won't delve into that. We've been talking about bubbles. That's how we got into this topic. We've been talking about the Fed and the other central banks around the world have the bubble machines going. They've been printing money in reality, Jim, like we have never seen before in the last 100 years, but trillions of dollars. And when all of this money is created, and a lot of it isn't directly observed by the public as it's being created. Sometimes it's masked. But when all of that money is created, it has to go somewhere. We saw it on the tech bubble in the 90s. We saw it on the real estate bubble that happened in the first part of this century. Where do you think all of this money is going to run this next round?
You know, to really understand or grasp this, I do believe we're going to see another bubble. It's just a question of looking around. What are the fundamental factors out there that would cause money to gravitate? In other words, there's got to be something underlying a bubble. When you talked about technology in the 90s, it was like the new economy, the digital age, the age of the internet. So there has to be something fundamental. Same thing with the housing market. Boy, real estate can only go up. So there's got to be something that attracts money into a sector. And what's really important, in addition to understanding, let's say, the business cycle, if you overlay, let's say, the monetary theory of asset prices on top of the business cycle, you have a better understanding what drives these markets. And the monetary theory is nothing new. You've seen people from John Maynard Keynes to Milton Friedman to James Tobin talk about it. And really what monetary theory of asset prices does, it studies the supply and demand for money and the flow of funds as it influences asset prices. And as we have always talked on this show, when governments create money, either through fiscal policy or monetary policy, that money has two outlets. It can go into the economy, it can go into financial markets, and then if the money flows into financial markets, when new money is created by central banks, the first recipient, hands down, tends to be the capital markets, not the economy. And just a good example of this is go back to March of this year. We had these huge infusions of capital to stem the financial crisis and stem the deflationary crisis that it looked like we were heading into. They stabilized the market, and then the Fed announced quantitative easing. They got rid of mark-to-market write-downs, and after those two events occurred in March, the markets have been on an upward track. Now, if money has two outlets, either the economy or the financial markets, let's talk about the financial markets. If money goes into financial markets, what kind of trades? There's two kinds of trades that you generally see. One are portfolio trades. It might be investors or a fund company that is looking to buy stocks based on either fundamentals or, for example, you may have a stock on the radar screen and say, boy, I'd like to own a particular company, but I'm not going to buy it until it gets down to a level where I consider it to be, you know, my margin of safety. So you have sort of like this value approach that goes into these trades. The other kind of trade is called a liquidity trade. And a liquidity trade is there's money out. You're sitting on money. Interest rates today are at 0%. And so you get liquidity that flows into the market. And that is obviously having an impact on driving asset prices up. Because we have two ways that money is created in the economy. We have the printing press money, the Fed creates money, it injects money into the banking system, banks increase their holdings of government debt, the money supply expands, and then you have fountain pen money, is when a bank or a financial intermediary makes a loan and creates new money from that loan that goes into deposits.
The central banks, Jim, create all of this excess money. Why is this such an important concept? Because if we go back to some of the deflationists that we heard over the last few weeks here on the program, they feel that isn't going to run out into some type of a bubble arena. They believe, you know, people are going to squirrel it away in their mattresses. They're going to be saving it in bank accounts or whatever. And that as a result, we won't really see the effects of the inflation in the marketplace.
One of the things I've been talking about in the last couple of weeks is banks only account for 26% of the credit in this country. 74% of our credit comes from outside the banking system. But when you have more money than what the economy needs, that money is going to go in one of three places. It can go on goods and services, or two, it can go into the financial markets. And if it goes in the financial markets, it can split in two directions. It can go in the purchase of domestic assets, whether it's buying U.S. stocks or bonds, as is occurring today, or it can go into non-dollar assets, let's say overseas, investing in foreign markets. And this is one of the things the deflationist did not understand about Japan. A lot of Japan's money left Japan, and it was invested in non-yen assets, which gave us the yen carry trade. But the important thing to understand here is major bull markets occur when some fundamental factor, either an improvement in the economy, an economy coming out of the recession, is when you see fundamental and monetary factors moving in the same direction. And when that happens, it can create a very powerful move in the bull market. And that's something that James Grant of Grant's Interest Rate Observer recently wrote when he was talking about becoming a bull. And one of the things that has really struck me, and we mentioned this in the last hour, from a lot of the professionals that I talk to around the globe, and especially coming out of Asia, and especially some of the big institutional consulting firms in the financial arena, everywhere they go, John, people don't believe this market rally or this is a bull market. They simply don't buy it. Everybody's looking for another crash. Everybody's looking for another downturn. And so they're not picking up on that if you have fundamental improving economies in the U.S., maybe it won't be as robust as it was, let's say, in previous decades, and you have emerging economies like China. China now becoming, or is probably going to surpass Japan to become the second largest economy of the world. You have the Brazilian economy, the economy in India, the Middle Eastern economies. This can drive or provide a fundamental backdrop in which monetary assets or liquidity can flood into. So right now, you've got fundamental factors and monetary factors all working in the same direction, and not too many people in the financial community are buying into this. And it's kind of like the old saying that the generals are fighting the last war. And when excess money is created, that money can be spent on assets, and if it does, it has a direct effect on asset prices, as we're seeing today. I don't care if you look at world markets, which are up anywhere from 18 to as much as 60% in China. If you're looking at the commodity space, where you've seen, for example, crude prices nearly double this year, you've seen even natural gas prices going up, gold prices up nearly 18%, silver up nearly 60%, platinum prices up 42%, palladium up 71%, aluminum prices up 28%, copper up 110%, lead up 116%, and we have other assets, I mean, corporate bonds, bonds in general going up, junk bonds going up, corporate bonds going up. And so the thing that I think is being missed here is the impact that this excess money is going to have on asset classes, and that's the primary beneficiary of what we call, you know, this excess liquidity or artificial money that's being created by these central banks. And so it's obviously had an impact on equities. And the thing that really strikes me as I look around, there are far too many bears right now. I'll give you an example. If we look at trading on Thursday, almost half of the trading on Thursday this week was short selling. So I think there could be some surprises here. Nobody believes in this bull market. John, let's go to the Laszlo Borini clip on a bull market.
You were one of the first people to call a bull market after all this turmoil, and you still firmly believe that a year ago from today that we are now in a bull market.
Yeah, I think yesterday was more evidence that over the weekend there were a number of articles which said we were having a correction. We're down 3%. Yesterday's resilience is one of the things you see in bull markets where the market takes it on the chin and comes back. So there's no change in our view on that point.
Laszlo mentioned what happened yesterday, but a lot of people still talk about it being a momentum-driven market. Mm-hmm. Laszlo, I'd love to get your perspective on that, because there are a lot of people out there that are not comfortable with valuations at their current level, even if the momentum suggests the stocks are going to continue to go higher.
Well, I think what the market is sort of forecasting is you're going to have a better recovery than people think they are. Ralph Lauren was upgraded today. Ralph Lauren's up about 100% the last 3 months. Now, I appreciate the consumer has debt. I appreciate the consumer has mortgage issues. But when you have a Ralph Lauren and some of these other stocks acting the way they are, I think that gives you some good signs about the economy in general. And so I think the valuations, you could say they're stretched, but the market's suggesting that maybe that E part of the PE will be a pleasant surprise.
And we've been talking about that, you know, about the E part of all of this and whether or not that is going to, that means that the market is fairly valued.
Yes. I think people are forgetting. The other thing you have to remember, at the beginning of a bull market, all your parameters and all your metrics get totally stretched. The measures, for example, of overbought, they're just totally out the window, at least temporarily. And so when you had this first rush, some of the things that you use on a historical basis have to be stretched, have to be bent, have to be put aside. And I think that's also true in the fundamental case.
What he was talking about, you know, valuations, overbought situations, PE ratios are high because of declining earnings during the downturn. And right now, they always say bull markets climb a wall of worry. And the majority of what I hear from a lot of managers is a lot of people are bearish. And it's amazing, John, because with all this liquidity, it's going to go somewhere. So we are going to see another bubble, because every time you do this, there's a bubble that occurs. We've seen it decade after decade where a fundamental story, and we'll get into how bubbles are created, financial bubbles. There was a book called Manias and Panics written by Charles Kindleberger that kind of documents the sequence. But, you know, if you look at the 60s, it was entertainment stocks and conglomerates. In the 70s, it was gold. In the 80s, it was the Nikkei. In the 90s, it was the NASDAQ. And so far in this decade, it's been oil. And I think that could go well into the next decade. So the money's going to go somewhere. So I think the key question investors need to ask themselves, where's the next bubble going to form? In other words, what are fundamental factors out there that's going to cause money that is being created to gravitate and obviously inflate those assets?
What do you think, then? What's a good likely candidate here?
I really think you're going to have to look outside the United States this time, because if you take a look at the credit constraints, especially in the private sector with so much consumer debt, the U.S. economy is going to be constrained. It's, you know, everybody's talking about the new normal of lower economic growth. I think we're heading more towards stagflation. Also, the U.S. is becoming anti-business and anti-capital. And so there are a lot of things that are going on in the United States right now that are big negative, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But I think if you're going to look for the next, I guess, target for the next investment stampede, I think you're really going to have to look at emerging markets. I think that's where we're likely to see it. And if you take a look at just the world markets this year, and this will give you an idea, the Chinese market is up 60%, the Korean market up 46%, the Taiwan market up 64%, Brazil's market up 70%. So you're already seeing, or this is seems to be confirming this thesis, that this is where the next financial bubble is going to emerge. And so I think if you're an investor, you've got to start thinking internationally. Let's pick up on the clip where Bill Gross talks about that.
Bill Gross, with the splash of a new normal coming out of your theme, we spoke with your colleague Richard Clarida yesterday. When you filter all this together, when is the length of the new normal? And is this a question of 2 years, 5 years, or do you look at, is this as a decade event?
Yeah, we look at it as a long-term event, Tom, whether it's a
3 years or 5 years or 10 years, I guess, depends upon the adjustment that takes place going forward. But the new normal is really based upon delevering, re-regulating, and actually a mild reversal of globalization forces. And so these are long-term things that need time to play out. It's not a quick cyclical recovery that produces a V-shape.
What is the significant change we need to make in our investment habits given this dampened nominal GDP? Is it a question of going more international? Is it a question of loading up on your total return fund? Sales pitch there. How do you adapt an investment portfolio given such a tempered outlook?
Well, I think the point you mentioned about going global is the main focus. I mean, depending upon what you want, whether you want steady income or whether you want, high returns and growth, I think the global approach is really the way to go. The United States is at the center of delevering as opposed to accelerating growth. Asia, Brazil, the emerging or the former emerging countries are really where growth rates are high and will continue to be high, and so equity orientation should be there. Fixed income orientation should probably be focused on, some of the G7 types of economies that are slow growth and that will require relatively low rates and, importantly, steep curves where bond returns can be magnified over time.
So what you're basically saying, if we go back to earlier, all this new money is going to create a new mania. It almost invariably does. Why don't you step us through the phases of when a mania is created? And I'm going to guess you're probably thinking this is going to be on an international basis.
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, there was a book written a number of years ago. He's since passed on. Charles Kindleberger authored a book called Manias, Panics, and Crashes. And there's sort of a sequence that all of these bubbles follow. And Kindleberger's model for a mania starts with some kind of displacement or some kind of exogenous shock to the macro system. And then what happens is this displacing event, think of technology, the internet in the 90s, it becomes widely followed, and it leads to a kind of new era thinking. John, you remember in the 90s with the advent and proliferation of computers in our lives, cell phones, the internet, we were heading towards a new economy. So we get this new era thinking, and the second step is the displacement or disturbance in the macro system is something that's been forming in years. It's not something that happens overnight. If you look at the development of China that began in the latter part of the 90s and the change in Chinese leadership, it was in the gestation stage. And so you have to have something that's kind of building. And then all of a sudden you get a catalyst that unleashes it. It captures the imagination of the public. Just think back what was going on in the tech phase, and also think back in this decade with real estate. I can remember Fortune magazine interviewing this guy that would drive around. He was in his 30s, and he'd buy 10 homes with very little money down, and people thought they were going to get rich buying second, third homes. And so the displacing event, there's a catalyst that triggers it. It catches on. And then there's got to be a convenient way to invest. It was easy to invest in technology. You just bought tech stocks or tech mutual funds. In real estate, it became very easy to invest in the real estate bubble because think of the proliferation of loans, no doc loans, no money down loans, all of the junk financing that came out from financial intermediaries or the shadow banking system. So there's got to be a convenient way to invest. And you can do that today. If you want to think about international markets, you can buy not only foreign stocks, for example, that's what we do. We can go on foreign exchanges and buy companies, international companies, or for individual investors, you can buy ETFs. And then what happens is you get all the theory that backs up the rise in asset prices. And then finally, at the end, there's another displacing event and the mania comes to an end. And so, if we look at all the possible candidates right now for a displacing event, and it's got to be the emerging world. It's got to be, for example, the emerging middle class in Asia displacing the American middle class. And remember, there's about 3 or 4 billion people on that side of the planet versus 300 million Americans. The other thing is, in the past, everybody would look towards the U.S. Now, the world is no longer relying on the American consumer to mop up excess production or spend excess savings. American consumers tapped out, although I don't think you can count them out. Moreover, this new administration's pursuing policies that are going to increase the cost of doing business, and also the fact that other markets are reducing the cost of doing business. They're trying to open their markets. They're becoming more open. Their markets are expanding. And especially if you take a look at China, Brazil, India. And so that's why I think that if we're looking for where the next bubble is going to emerge, I think you're going to see it emerge in emerging markets, because capital will go where it's best treated. Why would you come here with 0% interest rates? Why would you come here with anti-business policies? Why would you come here with rising taxes? If you look at Asia, other countries, Russia, China, Hong Kong, and other countries around the globe, they're talking about reducing taxes. So capital is going to flow elsewhere, and that's why I think you're going to see it flow to the BRIC countries.
Well, if we follow that theme up then, Jim, given that the emerging markets are probably going to be the next bubble up, how would you invest? What are you going to do?
You know, if I was in the U.S., I would look especially at U.S. multinationals that have a very, very strong presence in the emerging markets and get a good majority of their sales overseas. They would also be a beneficiary of a declining dollar. You know, I'm just going to throw out an example. You take a company like Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola gets 80% of its revenues from overseas. So large companies, multinational companies, I would look at also foreign companies, just as you have large cap multinational companies in the United States. I would also look at large multi-cap companies overseas. And so foreign companies would be a second component. And then a third component is commodities, which are going to be a direct beneficiary of these emerging markets, and especially China. So I would look at the things that in the area of commodities, the things that these emerging markets need, and also the things that these emerging markets don't have. So in the commodity space, if you're thinking of China, think of China not just in the sense of what China needs, but also what China does not have. China does not have enough energy in it to meet all its energy demands. It doesn't have enough copper. It doesn't have enough iron ore. It doesn't have enough grains. And so this is a third way that you can participate it. So if I was to summarize, John, large cap multinational companies that are more exposed to overseas economies versus small cap domestic companies that are highly dependent strictly on the U.S. economy, because the U.S. economy is going to be the slow grower this time. That's not where you're going to see the supercharged economic growth. Secondly, foreign companies, especially as these markets develop and it becomes a larger market worldwide, and especially as foreign markets develop. And the third would be commodities.
And the Financial Sense News Hour continues with more here on The Big Picture at financialsense.com.
I got bubble trouble. Call somebody quick and help me on the double. I got bubble trouble, bubbles all over me.
Well, this week we're doing something special on the Financial Sense News Hour. We're going to have an energy roundtable on investing in peak oil. I've asked to join us on the program the investment management team from Logi Energy, who manage the Peak Oil Value Fund, which is a hedge fund designed to take advantage of peak oil. Joining me on the program is its CEO, Larry Ortega. Also on the program is Dennis Mangan. He's VP of Hedging Operations. Alex Brown, Vice President of Trading. Jeffrey Brown, Vice President of Global Oil Supply Analysis. Rune Lickvern, who's Vice President of Global Oil Demand Analysis. And Chris Nelder, Vice President of Global Oil Transition Analysis. And Larry, let me ask and begin our discussion with you. Is there undiscovered value in the oil and gas industry? We've seen, for example, if you take a look at the S&P sectors this year, you're taking a look at some sectors that have done well, some that haven't, and one laggard has been energy. Energy is up, let's say, 9.5%. You have the S&P 500, which is up nearly 18%. So let's talk about value in the industry. Can investors find companies today that are either producing oil less than, let's say, $15 a ground, and who have nice margins and growing top-line growth?
Absolutely, Jim. Well, we've been looking and scouring the New York Stock Exchange, and it didn't even take that much hard looking at all to find. And we found many, many companies in the tens of companies, that when you took a look at these companies and understood both their present value and the net present value of their proven reserves, that you could effectively buy oil for less than $15 a barrel in the ground. And, of course, as we look forward strategically at peak oil and what it's going to cause in the rise of the price of oil and possible oscillations like that, we see the opportunity that in the future you will not be able to buy these companies at those prices. In addition, not only are you buying the price currently, the oil currently in the ground at $15 a barrel, you're buying operating teams that know how to work in these fields and know how to pull that oil out of the ground at a very low price. And I am not talking about offshore companies or stranded oil or gas. I'm talking about plain old-fashioned oil and gas right here in the United States and elsewhere in the world that's relatively easy to access. We look at that, we say that not only is the price going to go up on this oil and affect the price of these companies, but the price-to-earnings ratio, which is right now running in the low teens for most of these companies, we expect that to absolutely skyrocket. And as we see that price-to-earnings ratio skyrocket up like that, the combination of the two could be just a superb combination for making money here inside of oil and gas. Now, of course, we don't think it's going to stay this way forever. It's just a matter of time.
I want to address my next question to Jeff Brown, who is VP of Global Oil Supply Analysis. And, Jeff, you've done something about the land export model. And I wonder if you would explain the difference between peak oil and peak exports. And what is the definition of net oil exports? Because one of the things that anytime you hear the pundits talk about oil, we always say, okay, OPEC can produce X amount. But one of the things that we have seen in this last decade is producing countries, especially within OPEC, are consuming more and more the product that they produce.
Yeah, Jim, that's correct. And you know, I've got a kind of a somewhat graphical illustration that I kind of use to describe the two. I think peak oil is sort of akin to a commercial airliner doing a gradual descent for landing. Peak exports is more akin to a terrifying near vertical dive into the ground. A typical producing region, once it peaks, tends to have a low single-digit exponential decline, say 2% to 4% per year or something like that. Well, at 2% decline rate, your production falls by half in about 35 years. Now, but we did it to this little export land model, ELM. We just said, here's a hypothetical exporting country. It's got 2 million barrels a day of production, 1 million barrels a day of consumption. Let's say production falls at a rate kind of like the North Sea, about 5% per year. And let's assume consumption grows at 2.5% per year. Now, what happens is your production in about 9 years falls to 1.3 million barrels, but your consumption goes up to 1.3, so you hit zero exports. And then if you further delve into the math on this thing, what it shows is the net export decline rate, the amount of oil, you know, country exports net, which is defined as domestic production less consumption, that net export decline rate tends to accelerate with time. So instead of like a 2% or 5% decline rate, it goes like 2, 5, 7, 9 into double-digit decline rates. And there are three characteristics associated with the net export declines. The net export decline rate exceeds the production decline rate. The net export decline rate tends to accelerate with time, and the decline tends to be front-end loaded. The bulk of post-peak exports are shipped early in the decline phase. So even if we're showing a small decline in net exports, we're in the early part of the decline when we're shipping the bulk of net oil exports, of the cumulative post-peak cumulative oil exports.
I want to add a follow-up question, if I may, Jeff. One of the things that we've seen with the IEA report that came out last November in their study of 800 of the largest oil fields in the world, they found out that the depletion rate was much larger than they originally anticipated. Secondarily, they said in order to keep up, we were going to have to run faster and faster. And they were saying that the world needed to invest between $350, $400 billion just to meet existing demand and make up for depletion. With the credit crisis that hit the markets last year, we have seen company after company, both international oil companies and national oil companies, cut back on major expenditures. So if you take a look at, and this is even within OPEC itself, so if you have OPEC, for example, investing less, consuming more, and adding depletion to that, then on top of that you throw growing demand, it seems to me, as we look into the next decade, somewhere down the road, whether it's 2011, 12, 13, who knows what year it is, we're heading for a train wreck.
Well, I think the principal reason for the run-up in oil prices was importers bidding for declining oil exports, and then the economy cracked in the fourth quarter, and we had a temporary supply demand imbalance in the fourth quarter and first quarter. One thing to clarify slightly, I think IEA was talking about decline rates in the existing fields. And so that's the amount of production you lose per year. And the decline rates in these older fields is quite high. But in regard to depletion per se, my co-author, Samuel Fouché, is a mathematical genius, in my opinion, has done some tremendous work on modeling the top five net oil exporters, which account for about half of current world oil exports. That Saudi Arabia, Russia, Norway, Iran, United Arab Emirates, it was technically the 2005 top five exporters. But our best case is that the top five cumulative net oil exports post-2005 is about 132 billion barrels. Now, put that in perspective, that's only about half of what the Saudis claim as their entire recoverable reserves. So what we're saying is our best case is the post-2005 cumulative oil exports from Saudi Arabia, Russia, Norway, Iran, United Arab Emirates is only about half of what Saudis are claiming for their proven reserves. And furthermore, in just the past 3 years, 2006, 7, and 8, the top five exported about 25 billion barrels of oil. That's real close to a fifth of what we think that they'll export post-2005. So in just 3 years, in effect, we think they've already depleted the fuel tank by 20%. So like what they would export after 2005, we think they've only got 80% left, and that's 20% gone in 3 years.
My next question I want to address to Dennis Mangan, who is VP of Hedging Operations. According to the EIA, how large is the current oversupply of, let's say, crude oil, heating oil, and gasoline? I mean, we get the figures every single week. It seems to move markets. And a secondary question to that, given the volatility of the market, maybe I'll address that to Alex afterwards. But Dennis, let's start with the inventory oversupply, because on the day we're speaking, we have West Texas Intermediate crude up nearly $2. You've got Brent up nearly $2. Let's address the oversupply problem.
Well, the oversupply, I'll just give you a year ago comparison. On crude oil, we have 35 million more barrels than we did a year ago, and a few weeks ago it was 52 million barrels. Then if you look at the distillate, which is where the real huge problem is, we're sitting there at our all-time record high of 172 million barrels, roughly, in storage, which is 50 million barrels above where it was a year ago. I mean, it's a terrific glut. So right there you have 85 million more barrels. And in gasoline, you're 27 million barrels. So, you know, your excess of 100 million barrels, not including that we filled up the SPR during the same time frame, and we put all this together, we're probably pushing 150 million barrels. We're 22 million barrels up in the SPR. So what we have here is we've had an enormous build in inventories, while at the very same time, we've had a terrific collapse in the demand for distillate. The demand for distillate is over the last 10 years is at its 12th percentile. In other words, basically 12% of the amount of product supplied to the market is lower than the current amount we're supplying to it. And obviously the remainder, 88%, is higher. So our problem right now is the fact that we have incredibly low demand for distillate. And if we don't eat into this huge supply going into winter, when we normally would, we're going to end up with a problem that we're going to have to start shutting refineries down. And probably in the near future, and we've already shut a few down, there will be more to come. The processing margin basically is terrible. In heating oil, the margin is basically underneath its 50th percentile at the 43rd. And in gas, as we go into winter, over the last year, 10 years, measuring the gas crack spread, you're down to the 6th percentile. In other words, only 6% of the instances of the gas crack are lower than the current number we're looking at.
What do you think is driving the price then? Is oil responding as a monetary asset then?
Well, what you have right now is you have a terribly weak U.S. dollar. And my suspicion is that if the dollar had not weakened up 15% over the last number of months, you'd probably be looking at an oil price not at 70. You'd probably be looking at an oil price in the 40s or the low 50s.
My next question I want to address to Alex Brown, who runs trading operations. The oil and gas markets seem to be range-bound. We've been like 65, 75. What do you think might be the trigger to cause them to break out?
On the downside, the trigger was clearly a reversal of the dollar. What we're seeing in the dollar is pretty outstanding in terms of the move we've had since the March lows in equities. And this trade has become so crowded globally between institutional investors shorting the dollar to fund risk-taking assets, that when this reversal occurs, it would probably not be a slow reversal. It would be a very fast reversal, and that would immediately impact the price of oil. As Dennis said, what we are seeing in oil is a price that cannot break through basically its May highs. What's been interesting about oil is it's still at 75 from May through now in terms of hitting a peak, yet equities have rocketed well beyond their May highs. So clearly there seems to be a fundamental case to say that oil should be weaker right now, but we have the dollar supporting that upward price. So therefore, the big trigger for reversal is going to be a reversal in the currency market.
Let me throw something out that we saw in the 70s. A lot of people thought we had oil or peak oil or shortages in the 70s. It was more geopolitical, but it was also a period that was characterized by a steep decline in the value of the dollar throughout that decade. Could we see a repeat of that pattern going forward?
Clearly, you could see a repeat of the dollar in a orderly decline. But the difference between the late 70s and now is inflation. What's really a difference in these markets today versus conditions you described in the late 70s is interest rates. Back then, you had interest rates that were double digits. Right now, what's been fascinating about this market has been the bids for the 10-year and 30-year, where we're talking about interest rates below 3.2 on the 10-year and 4 or less on the 30-year, which is not indicative of inflation. So there's a real difference in interest rates between the market you described and the one we're currently trading in.
Now, Jim, this is Larry Ortega speaking here just real quickly. We were talking also about this earlier today, and Dennis mentioned to me a story that relates to exactly what you just asked about how the Saudis, who decided to take control of the oil market during the 70s, and he has an interesting approach right now to what they may be doing to actually move the market today. Dennis, tell us just a little bit about what you think.
Well, yeah, if you look at it from the point of view of the Saudi Arabians, and they're the swing producer in OPEC, oftentimes when I'm talking to my consulting clients who I advise on how to hedge off their risks in a variety of areas in the energy markets, I play a game with them called If I Was Saudi Arabia, which is kind of a fun game to play in certain ways. But if I was Saudi Arabia, I would not want all these projects and all this drilling taking place that has been planned, announced, in some cases gone forward as the price advanced basically from $40 to $150. As I told many people many years ago, if you want to average 25 in oil in your Saudi Arabia, you don't want the average to be in a range of 20 to 30. You want it to be in a range of 10 to 40. The volatility will scare away people from investing in oil-based projects. The other thing that's going on right now in the Middle East is that compliance with the restrictions on supplying the market from OPEC has decreased. It was over 88%. Now, apparently, it's down to the 60% area. And the same thing happened in 1985-86 when the Saudis cut back their production sharply, only to see the rest of OPEC increase their production and basically steal market share from the Saudis. They promptly opened the spigots up, and they drove the price down in about 13 weeks from the mid-20s to 10 bucks a barrel. If I was the Saudis, nice game to play, what I would do is if I wanted an average price of 70, I would get 70, but I would get it basically in a range of between 20 and 120. I wouldn't want to get 70 in a range of 60 to 80, because 60 to 80 will draw plenty of interest into investing in oil. but $10 or $20 will discourage everybody from doing it, and they'll shelve a whole bunch of projects. Therefore, the Saudis don't have to compete with that oil. It'll be pushed off sometime into the future.
This question is addressed to Jeff Brown. What is your outlook for future net oil exports? And you talked about the top five. Do you factor in also demand, incremental demand coming in from, let's say, what's going on in China, what's going on in India, what's going on with, even a lot of the producing nations and even consuming nations in the developing world who have a tremendous demand for energy where the product is subsidized, whether you're looking at Middle Eastern countries or you're looking at, for example, Venezuela?
We're going to be presenting our work at the Association for Study Peak Oil and Gas Conference this coming weekend. I'm delivering our paper on October 11th. And one of the things that really surprised me in working the paper up was the enormous increase in consumption in the non-OECD countries, the developing countries, versus the developed OECD countries like U.S. countries in Europe, etc. From 1998 to 2008, average annual oil prices went from $14 to $100. And that's an increase of just about 20% per year on average for 10 years. So in response to that, U.S. consumption pretty much flatlined. And in 2008, our consumption was back to exactly the same level as 1999, 19.5 million barrels per day. So the recent current weakness in U.S. demand is nothing new. It's really part of the same 10-year trend we've seen. But over that same time frame, I pulled out four examples and just showed a normalized chart of consumption for the U.S. versus Morocco, Kenya, India, China. Morocco increased their consumption over the 10 years by 30%. Kenya was about 47%. India was 62%. And China was about 93%. That's their total petroleum increase over a 10-year period when the U.S. basically flatlined. So what it suggests is the developing countries have an inherent advantage over the developed countries in a rising price environment. Furthermore, that would also hold true in exporting countries. You know, there are three reasons I think this export model works. Number one, we've seen no exceptions to the rule. We looked at 23 examples in exporting countries, and in every single case, the export decline rate exceeded the production decline rate, and it tended to accelerate with time. And second, you frequently have subsidies in these exporting countries. But third, irrespective of subsidies and net export math, I think these developing exporting countries are going to have an inherent competitive advantage over developed countries like the U.S. in regard to bidding for oil supplies. And finally, there's the old joke about the drunk looking for his car keys under the streetlight late at night after leaving the bar. You know, he lost his keys down the street, but the light was better under the streetlight. I think that's a little bit true for our focus on U.S. inventories and data versus the non-OECD countries. We've got great data in the U.S. That's not where all the growth in consumption has been in the past 10 years. It's been in the non-OECD developing countries.
This next question is one on the minds of this administration and certainly been brought up. T. Boone Pickens has talked about using natural gas for transportation fuel. I want to address this one to Chris Nelder. Is it time to get serious thinking about alternative energy, or is it still too early? In other words, do we really have some alternative choices that could be quite profitable and economic? And it seems to me that where we consume most of our energy is in the transportation system. What are the possibilities, and how do alternatives work? Is it going to be plug-in hybrids? Is it going to be just hybrids? In other words, is this the time for alternatives, and what are those alternatives?
Well, Jim, is it too early? No. 30 years ago would not have been too early, in my view, because when you take a look at the decades that it takes to replace any significant proportion of the vehicles that are out there and start running them on something other than petroleum-based liquid fuels, it really takes an enormous amount of time. And as I believe that we are now at the peak of global oil production and likely to go into decline around 2012, 2013, we really have no time at all to begin that transition. So definitely not too early. I think there's going to be a whole suite of different approaches to the problem. Certainly, I think T. Boone Pickens' concept of running you know, tractor trailer rigs on natural gas is a very good one. There's a lot of other technologies, hydraulic storage systems and things like that, that also come into play in that sector. As far as personal vehicles go, I do think there's a great future for plug-in hybrids and straight electric cars. But again, we're looking at a very slow rate of uptake compared to how quickly we need to start replacing these vehicles. No, I don't think it's too early. I think there's a whole host of investment opportunities in this sector that are going to be terrific long-term buy-and-hold plays. I am particularly excited about the recent IPO of A123, lithium-ion battery maker focused on that sector. There's a lot of work being done all around the world in this area. I mean, France just made another $2 billion commitment to electric car charging infrastructure. They plan to deploy over a million electric car charging points in the next couple of years. So absolutely, it's a terrific time to get into that area.
Chris, let me follow up with another question, and you hear the administration talk about this. Can alternative energy be used to fill the gap as a steep drop-off that Jeff Brown talked about from exports hits OECD countries? In other words, can we move fast enough with these alternatives, whether it's the Pickens plan or hybrids from Toyota, to offset the sharp fall off in exports to developed countries that is certainly going to hit us here in the next decade?
I don't think there's any chance of that at all. In fact, I did a little quick math yesterday based on the most recent data available from the EIA and found that just in terms of BTUs equivalent, if we wanted to simply make up for the global depletion of mature oil-producing regions by using renewable energy, that we would have to essentially take the entire current installed base of renewable energy supply in the world and repeat that every single year from 2012 on out. And then we would have to build even more capacity as the years progress because the rate of decline in oil will accelerate. So that would be just to make up for overall depletion worldwide. The steep drop-off in oil exports for the OECD will be much sharper than that. So I cannot imagine how alternative energy could fill that gap. But obviously we're going to do everything that we can, and you know, the more we do, the better. It's just going to lessen the pain.
I want to go back to Alex with this next question. Earlier in this decade, as the price of oil rose from 20 to 40, Wall Street was taken back and surprised, but something that we've seen changed in the last, well, I'd say maybe year or two, is the big investment banks are now seem to have caught on to the peak oil bug and are suggesting peak oil trades to their customers. Goldman just came out. They're upping their oil forecast to $85 a barrel by the end of the year, $95 to $100 by the end of the next year. What do you think brought about the change on Wall Street with the big investment banks? And that seems to be a theme that has caught on now on Wall Street.
I think it's been, in terms of changing opinions on Wall Street, it's been a combination of the massive volatility in the price of oil, which is a characteristic of peak oil. As supplies become more scarce of a commodity, not only does that commodity tend to go up, it also tends to become more volatile in price. And that's precisely what a long-term chart of oil will demonstrate to you. And many of the analysts on Wall Street are starting to pick up on these effects and put this into their pricing model. And what you are seeing is, in terms of recommendations from the big investment banks, they are suggesting that if you are going to buy an equity of an oil and gas equity or an integrated equity, their recommendations tend to be more and more focused on those names that are exposed more to rising oil prices as opposed to steady oil prices. In other words, the companies that are more levered and have more exposure to just outright spot prices are the ones that they recommend their clients purchase. And if you read the research reports, this is clearly what they're recommending to their clients these days.
And I guess as we conclude, a final question, I'd like to address this to you, Larry. If you had to go long or short right now with oil prices close to $72 a barrel, what direction would you set your oil and gas trades? Would you be short with a fully hedged upside position later this winter? Would you get long in a big way or always fully hedged?
Well,
right now, based on what we're understanding things through Dennis and what's going on inside the EIA, it would be absolutely imprudent for us to be anything but short. So we would clearly be short, but we would be fully hedged so we could reset the position as it bounces along like it's been here. In addition to that, we would probably also hedge the position against the dollar because we could be right and effectively, in a real sense, real dollar sense, the price of oil is dropping, but if the value of the dollar drops even faster, you're never going to see it. It's never going to happen for you. I know it's a little bit complex, but basically we would be short, we'd be fully hedged in that short, and we would also hedge ourselves against the dollar and its movement.
And then maybe a final question from each one of you. If you had to look out the IEA when it issued its report last November and then a subsequent report, is talked about a coming train wreck in the area of energy. And I know, Jeff, you addressed this in your land export model where, you know, the producers are not only consuming more of what they consume, but also given depletion rates. If you had to put a time frame on a, let's say, an energy train wreck, number one, do you think that is a valid concern? And number two, if you do think it's a valid concern, put a time frame.
Absolutely a valid concern. And I'll put it this way. I think in 2009, we were seeing a combination of involuntary plus voluntary reductions in net oil exports. I think we're going to transition next year, 2010, to mostly involuntary net oil export declines. And one of the things we didn't mention was Canada, Venezuela, and Mexico. Their combined net exports in 2004 were 5 million barrels a day to all importers. They were down to 4 million barrels a day last year. They dropped a fifth. They dropped a million barrels a day, one-fifth drop in 4 years. Mm. Those are three of our four largest sources of imported oil, and that there are three closest major sources of imported oil. And it's that decline is happening right at our back door. And by the way, not only, you know, Mexico is declining rapidly because of the Cantarell field crash, but Venezuela has been falling, I think, since 1997, 98. And Canada has been showing an increase in production and exports, but they declined last year also. Everyone assumes Canadian tar sands production can offset conventional decline, and that may happen to some degree going forward. But at least last year, Canadian increase in tar sands production is not able to fully offset the decline in conventional production just in Canada. So all three of those countries showed a declining exports last year. So I think we're back to importers bidding against each other for declining oil exports next year, and primarily because of involuntary declines in net oil exports. And then from there, I think it's just a question of when you get another break in the world economy because of rising oil prices. And I think it's going to be a cyclical pattern of higher highs and higher lows.
Well, gentlemen, I would like to thank all of you for joining us in this roundtable discussion on peak oil investing. If our listeners would like to find out more about the Peak Oil Value Fund, is there a website or a way that they could do so, please?
Absolutely. It's logipeakoil.com, Jim.
Logi, and that's L-O-G-I?
Yes, sir. L-O-G-I, peakoil.com, all one word there.
Well, to Dennis Mangan, Alex Brown, Jeffrey Brown, Larry, and we'd also like to thank Chris Nelder. I'd like to thank you for joining us on this discussion on peak oil investing. All the best to you, gentlemen. Have yourself a great weekend.
Thank you.
This was an abundantly busy show today. I like the roundtable was interesting. I think that's the largest number of people we've ever packed into a roundtable today.
How many do we have? We had five? Was it 5%?
One person had to exit in the middle of the conversation.
Yeah, we actually had, I believe, six. And we had one expert from Norway. And I don't know if it was telephone lines or what. But, yeah, that was quite a discussion.
Yeah, and we are working on debates. I think debates, people seem to be, we're getting a lot of feedback on the debate. So if you have some ideas for debate topics, by the way, out there, you go ahead and drop us an email or a line, or you can even leave it on the queue lines for that matter, and let us know what you think a good debate topic would be. And Jim, coming up in the following weeks as we pursue the crusade for truth with a capital V, Veritas, what can you verify? What are we doing?
Okay, next week I'm looking forward to this interview. It's one of the best books on oil. And for a lot of you that have followed the peak oil debate and also investing in oil, Morgan Downey, his book Oil 101 is probably one of the best books I've come across. And believe me, I've read, gosh, I'm probably up to 100 books on oil. He'll be my guest next week. Ian Plimmer, Heaven and Earth, October 24th. Richard Heinberg, his new book called Blackout on October 31st. Joseph Calahandro Jr., Applied Value Investing, will be on the program November 7th. Hunter Lewis, Where Keynes Went Wrong, on November 14th. Martin Gross, National Suicide, November 21st. And Axel Merck, one of our experts in the first hour, he's written a new book called Sustainable Wealth. And Axel will be our special guest on November 28th. Well, we've run out of time, and we'd just like to say on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until we all talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Roll out the barrel. We'll have a barrel of fun. Roll out the barrel. We've got the blues on the run. Sing boom terrero. Ring out a song of good cheer. Now's the time to roll the barrel.
You've been listening to the Financial Sense News Hour with Jim Poplava, sponsored by the PFS Group. The Financial Sense News Hour is for information and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell securities. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of Jim Poplava and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. As such, you should always consult a qualified financial consultant before making any investment decisions. Financial Sense News Hour will not be liable to any person for financial losses resulting from investing in any companies profiled or information provided on this radio program. The Financial Sense News Hour with Jim Poplava was produced by Steel on Seal Productions. Join us again next week for more in-depth investment, news, and analysis. This is the FSN Radio Network.